A fire crackles at the edge of a cave, its flickering light casting vague shadows onto the rock walls. A group of people are seated around the fire, men and women who look similar to us, but then not exactly the same. Something a little different about their build, the shape of their brows. Beyond the fire is complete darkness, only the moon and stars clear and bright in the night sky. This is long, long ago. Suddenly, lightning, a flash, then another, and a rumble of thunder. The people at the fire do not panic though, they have weathered many storms. They look up into the sky, prepared for rainfall, prepared to head into the shelter of the cave. And so they do not notice, at first, that in the noise and tumult, a figure has appeared. His skin is pale and smooth, his hair oddly cut. He is slim and tall. He wears strange coverings, tight things around his legs and chest. The stranger opens his mouth to speak, but what comes out is meaningless, a jumble of sounds no one understands. But then he does something with the object in his hands, and suddenly, when he talks, he says, clear and loud, "Hello, I am Friendly." The group stares. He continues, "And I have a question to ask." Days earlier, this time traveler, an inventor from the distant future, was preparing for just this moment. He had created a translation device, an instrument that he could use to understand any language. Tested on every dialect of his time, he knew it worked well, but he wanted to push it further. And so, he had thought of the ultimate test. How far back in time, he wondered, could he use his device? How far back could he go and communicate with his ancestors? And so, as he stood before the group assembled around the fire, he slowly enunciated his evaluation question, his device clicking and whirring as he did so. "How do you cook an egg?" These prehistoric Homo sapiens shared the world with some mysterious, long-lost cousins, and now we finally know what their faces look like. Denisovans, previously only known from a few small bones and teeth from a cave in Siberia, have been found to be genetically related to the Dragon Man fossil of Homo longi. Some people simply cannot say, "I went for a drink." In the Beric language, spoken by around 1,000 people living in 5 villages along the banks of the Tor River in Indonesia, you would be forced to specify when. Time phrases are encoded into Beric verbs, leaving no words that mean "I went for a drink." But you could say, "I went for a drink in the middle of the daytime." Conversely, Piraha, spoken by only one tribe in Amazonas, Brazil, has absolutely no concept of time. It is one of the phonologically simplest languages known, being constructed from between 10 and 13 phonemes or sounds. When talking about that drink in Piraha, there are no different ways to say "I drank," "I am drinking," or "I will drink," leaving all communication rooted in the present moment. Translation is not simple, and direct translation is often completely impossible. Indeed, the time traveler's universal translator would doubtless have been challenged by these unique languages, spoken in tiny pockets of today's world. But would he have similarly struggled as he traveled back to the dawn of language itself? How far back would he be able to go and still make sense of what was communicated to him? The origins of language have both fascinated and polarized scientists for centuries, with language itself regularly seen as a defining characteristic of being human. Victorian language professor Friedrich Max Müller despite being, in his own words, a diligent reader and sincere admirer of Charles Darwin's work, simply couldn't see fit to include human language within the influence of natural selection. What is it that man can do, and of which we find no signs, no rudiments in the whole brute world? I answer without hesitation, the one great barrier between the brute and man is language. Language is our Rubicon, and no brute will dare to cross it. However, a discovery several years earlier by French physician Paul Broca would put this in doubt. A discovery made in the head of a man called Tan. Tan was the nickname given to Louis-Victor Le Borgne, a 51-year-old who'd been hospitalized in Paris for over 20 years. He earned his nickname because the only syllable he could consistently utter was Tan. Despite this severe speech impediment, Tan could understand spoken language, follow instructions, and use gestures to communicate basic needs, indicating that his intelligence and comprehension were largely intact. And so after Tan's death in 1861, Broca performed an autopsy and discovered a lesion in the left frontal lobe, in what is now called the posterior inferior frontal gyrus, or Broca's area. Presenting his findings to the Society of Anthropology, Broca argued that this region was responsible for articulated language production, revolutionizing neuroscience by showing that language is not a spiritual faculty, but rather tied to specific structures in the brain that would be just as open to evolutionary changes and pressures as any other part of the body. But 70,000 years ago, the time at which our traveller begins his journey, Homo sapiens would have already been anatomically modern. And so knowing that, does that mean they would have spoken as well as we do? Our ancestors at this time would have looked remarkably like us. A stronger brow maybe, more rugged features, but otherwise they would differ very little from modern humans in their physicality. But their lives are vastly different. They don't yet farm or build cities. Instead, they move constantly, following herds of animals and the seasonal abundance of fruit, nuts, and roots. Fire, long since conquered, crackles in their camps, offering warmth and a place to cook whatever food they've scavenged or hunted. They fashion simple tools from stone, wood, and bone. These are not crude, but crafted with skills they pass down through the generations. Their social groups are tight-knit, likely composed of family members, a structure essential for survival in a harsh world. And so if we were to listen in on a group of Homo sapiens seated around their campfire, what might we hear? A century on from Broca's discovery, scientists have found that a vocal tract of early Homo sapiens provides anatomical evidence for the capacity for spoken language. A key feature is the descended larynx, which creates a longer pharyngeal cavity, a muscular tube in the neck that connects the mouth and nose to the esophagus and larynx, all held inside the throat. This longer cavity allows for a range of sounds, including distinct vowel formations, essential elements of complex speech. Indeed, all languages in the world today have vowel sounds. Some languages, just 3, others, like Danish, have 20. And so unlike non-human primates, whose higher-positioned larynx limits vocal flexibility, early Homo sapiens had a structure capable of producing rapid, varied phonemes, the smallest sound in a word that can change its meaning. But the lowered larynx is not the only evidence of complex speech capacity in Homo sapiens, and it's the combination of different facets of mouth, tongue, and throat anatomy that ultimately helps us modern humans create our complex language. Indeed, our flexible, rounded tongues, situated in the back of our throats, allow us to make a range of sounds that other animals cannot. Combined with the fine motor control of the lips and jaw, all of this suggests a sophisticated set of apparatus for making and manipulating a huge range of sounds, which is essentially a way of saying early Homo sapiens likely had words. And we can go even further, for language capacity is written even more deeply into Homo sapiens.
into our DNA.
Early Homo sapiens carried a unique version of the FOXP2 gene, a gene that is essential for proper development as well as vocalization abilities. And we know that modern humans with mutations in this gene today struggle with language comprehension and speech articulation in part thanks to a family living in Britain in the 1990s. The KE family had speech and language disorders present in three generations. About half of the family members exhibited severe difficulties with articulation, called orofacial dyspraxia, as well as difficulty understanding grammar and interpreting language. Genetic analysis, still a big undertaking in the 90s, linked their condition to a defect in FOXP2. Brain imaging of affected family members also revealed abnormalities in Broca's area, basal ganglia, and cerebellum, all brain regions involved in speech motor control. FOXP2, it seemed, was vital for language development. And FOXP2 is present in many animals, from chimpanzees to zebrafish, but in humans, it appears to play a role in neuroplasticity. It helps neurons in the brain change. And it's this ability to change that allows for the learning of language. Indeed, more recently, a group of researchers from Germany sat back in their labs and listened to something remarkable. Mice pups singing in a language influenced by human evolution. The researchers had made a vocal Frankenstein's monster of these baby mice, replacing the mouse version of FOXP2 with a humanized variant. Mice are known to produce ultrasonic vocalizations, high-frequency sounds beyond human hearing ability to communicate a range of needs, from mating calls to distress warnings. These genetically modified rodent pups produced ultrasonic vocalizations that were lower in pitch than those of their unaltered counterparts. And another study found that adult mice with the human version of FOXP2 used more complex syllables. And yet, FOXP2 is necessary, but not quite enough on its own for language development. But to further bolster our evidence, we can look beyond anatomy. Indeed, the various social abilities of these very early humans indicate something about the way they thought, and the way they communicated. These people were well skilled in toolmaking, from weapons to utensils. Though basic to our modern eyes, a complex stone tool with a specific shape and a sharpened edge can't be made by simply smashing two rocks together. It requires planning and dexterity. And so when we are looking for evidence of language, or even just some form of clear communication, the presence of so many tools throughout time periods provides clear clues. Toolmaking suggests an ability to pass knowledge down to others. To teach requires structured communication, and to teach something complex would certainly be much easier if communication came in the form of spoken language. We also know that Homo sapiens buried their dead with grave goods, and bodies arranged in very specific ways. Anthropologists see this as a clear sign of abstract thought and possibly even a belief system. For these early people to coordinate their society around a belief system, or at the least to agree on a set approach to burial, there must have been the ability to communicate complex, non-material ideas, perhaps about life, death, and an afterlife. And one of the most important pieces of evidence for early symbolic thinking is found in Blombos Cave, South Africa. Here were discovered pieces of ochre decorated with abstract patterns, etchings made with tools by ancient hands, a series of overlapping lines and zigzags. Too much decay left archaeologists in the dark about the true age of the artifacts. But this was the 1990s, and a new technology had emerged, optically stimulated luminescence, a method that measures when mineral grains last saw sunlight. The extended time these precious pieces of the past had spent beneath ground, the very thing that revealed their hidden origins. Buried in darkness, quartz slowly absorbs radiation from the earth. In the lab, a precise flash of blue light releases the stored energy, allowing scientists to calculate how long grains have been underground. And what this new technology revealed was fascinating. for the artifacts at Blombos Cave weren't 30,000 or even 50,000 years old. They stretched back 75,000 years, placing them within a brief but extraordinary burst of human creativity known as the Still Bay culture. This early in their existence, Homo sapiens were creating art. Today, we recognize that Homo sapiens developed symbolic culture in Africa tens of thousands of years before spreading across the world. These ancient people had the desire and ability to represent concepts and to render thought into physical form, to share ideas about art and creativity and advanced toolmaking, all enabled by advanced language skills. And so the brave time traveler would be the first to test this theory in the flesh. At the Homo sapiens camp, he approaches with his device. A young woman watches with curiosity as he lays down a couple of eggs he has brought for his experiment. The woman is interested. Without domesticated birds, eggs would be harder to come by here, relying on pickpocketing nests. The inventor asks once more, "How do I cook an egg?" The time traveler's translation device throws out some sounds, and the young woman tilts her head, grins, and finally speaks. Her language is unfamiliar, but it is clearly a language, structured but simple. The translator jumps back to life and says, "Put egg on stone. Stone hot from fire. Crack egg on stone. Stone is hot. Egg will cook. Eat egg." It is not complex, but it is clear. It is thought, speech, and communication. With the device, the inventor can converse with ancient Homo sapiens. Here is a language. It can translate. It is no doubt a fascinating start to his journey, but the traveler is eager to test his device further. What happens if he continues back in time? Will these words dissolve into nothingness? And if so, what will he find in their place? At Zoo Atlanta in Georgia in the United States, a gorilla locks eyes with a zookeeper holding a piece of food. But instead of reaching out to take her meal or grunting in frustration, she does something unexpected. The gorilla lets out a soft, sharp sound unlike anything the keeper has heard from the gorillas before. It sounds almost like a blend of a sneeze and a cough. Subtle, almost conspiratorial, as if the gorilla is trying to get the zookeeper's attention without alerting her groupmates. With time, researchers recorded this strange vocalization among more Western gorillas in the zoo, particularly adult females, in scenarios where a human held food. It was distinct from their usual calls, and intriguingly, when the researchers surveyed other zoos, they found the sound wasn't unique to Zoo Atlanta. Gorillas elsewhere had independently developed the same quiet, attention-seeking signal. These whisper-like sounds suggest an alternative to the belief that gorillas, similar to other great apes, have rigid, largely instinctual vocal repertoires. This strange noise, suited to such a specific scenario, suggested a capacity for vocal innovation, an ability to tweak and invent new vocalizations that hints at a deeper flexibility in their communication, perhaps even an evolutionary echo of how human speech began. However, this example is interesting for its rarity. In general, apes find it hard to modulate the volume and intensity of their vocalizations. Why? Part of the challenge lies in anatomy. Apes possess large air sacs attached to the hyoid bone, which amplify vocalizations, making their calls louder and more resonant. This adaptation is ideal for long-distance communication in dense forests, where booming calls can carry through the trees. Indeed, some primates take this even further, Siamangs, a species of gibbon, have an enormously enlarged hyoid bone, supporting a throat pouch that inflates dramatically, allowing them to produce calls that echo for over a kilometer. While useful for attracting mates or warning rivals, this sac-driven vocal system is poorly suited to precise, controlled speech. Clearly, somewhere along the evolutionary line, our ancestors lost these air sacs. When did this happen? And what did this mean for how we communicate? And so it is time for us to take the time traveler back a few more thousand years and test out his translator on a yet more distant ancestor. Homo heidelbergensis. Homo heidelbergensis lived across Africa, Europe, and parts of Asia between 300,000 and 800,000 years ago, thriving as skilled hunters. They used wooden spears, hunted large prey, and controlled fire. Indeed, we have found burnt bones, hearths, and expertly crafted spears from this period in sites such as Schöningen and Gesche Benoyakov. It is clear that their intelligence went beyond basic survival. They exhibited strategic thinking, cooperation, and possibly rudimentary communication. But did they have anything resembling true language? Well, if we did encounter Homo heidelbergensis and try to talk to them, though their response would likely not be total silence, it would not be anything close to the language of Homo sapiens. However, we can be fairly certain that they were capable of producing vowel sounds, the essential building blocks of speech. And if they combined those vowel sounds with progressive vocalizations, like clicking or tutting, this could be considered an early foundation for the language that would come many thousands of years later. A major clue comes from that small, horseshoe-shaped throat bone, about 5 to 6 centimeters wide, that we share with other primates and apes, the hyoid bone. Many mammals have this bone, but as we've seen, in the great apes, unlike humans, it is surrounded by air sacs. And these air sacs give apes the ability to be loud. Really loud. It's a useful tool, but it prevents subtle pitch control, limiting the complexity and nuance of our primate cousins' communications. Indeed, by testing anatomical models with and without air sacs, we know that if we were to add air sacs to a human throat, it would distort our vocalizations, rendering them unclear. And so at some point in evolutionary history, we humans lost the air sacs and gained the ability to be clearer and more varied in our vocalizations. But we don't know exactly when this loss occurred. What we do know now, though, is that it had happened whilst Homo heidelbergensis still walked the Earth, before the existence of Homo sapiens and Neanderthals. Most of what we know about extinct species comes from the bones that fossilize well. Big, dense structures like skulls, femurs, and teeth. In many cases, scavengers or passing animals destroy more fragile bones before they even have a chance to fossilize. And so, fossilized hyoid bones are very hard to come by. So hard that only a handful have ever been discovered. And, because the hyoid does not connect directly to any other bone in the body, it is easy for it to move away from its long-dead owner, carried off in the ebb and flow of soil movement through time. This means that to find an ancient hyoid bone at all is remarkable, and to find two, extraordinary. And 30 years ago, that is exactly what happened. Deep in the heart of Spain's Atapuerca Mountains lies Cima de los Huesos, the Pit of Bones. A silent, prehistoric crypt enclosed in earth for 400,000 years, accessible only by descending a 13-meter vertical shaft. Within the darkness, undisturbed for hundreds of thousands of years, lay the remains of at least 28 ancient hominins. Originally identified as Homo heidelbergensis, but now classified as not exactly that. DNA evidence has shown them to be related to Neanderthals, but not yet Neanderthal, with terms such as proto or pre-Neanderthal sometimes being used to describe them. Their bones, skulls, jaws, and teeth are all well preserved, and at the time of their discovery, made up around 80% of all discovered human fossils that lived between 720 and 130,000 years ago. And it was here that archaeologists found the two hyoid bones, the first in 1992, the second in 1994, and through them were able to rewrite the history of communication. For when scientists studied the fossils, they were able to confirm there had been no air sacs attached to these hyoid bones. This means that these hominins, living 400,000 years ago, were not screeching like apes, but in fact had the capacity for greater control over tone, pitch, and articulation. Their speech had the potential to be more structured and varied than a chimpanzee's hoots or an orangutan's booming calls. The DNA of these Cima de los Huesos hominins has also revealed that we, Homo sapiens, share a last common ancestor with them between 550 and 750,000 years ago. If we assume that the loss of air sacs was a single evolutionary event, rather than multiple species of hominin independently losing the characteristic, this would push back the event at least that far, right into the earlier days of Homo heidelbergensis. Other fossil evidence from skulls suggests that Homo heidelbergensis had a vocal tract shape closer to ours than an ape's. This vocal tract shape meant that they could likely produce the sounds A, I, and U, albeit with less stability than modern humans. Their speech would have been somewhat slurred and slow due to anatomical limitations. The building blocks of all this evidence is scant, but each tiny bone, each skull, each small piece of knowledge gained from a scan or a study works to tell us that the communication of Homo heidelbergensis and their contemporaries was probably far more than just a series of grunts. That they at least had the capacity, though we'll never know if it was actually used, for rhythm, pitch variation, and possibly even word-like sounds. But verbal communication is a two-way street. A species must not only produce complex sounds, but also hear them accurately. Another team working at Cima de los Huesos studied the fossilized ear bones discovered at the site. They found that they had a human-like pattern of sound perception. This differs from chimpanzees, who hear sounds outside the normal human speech range. If they could hear human-like frequencies, it suggests that sounds, structured like early speech and language, at least in its most primitive form, was already forming within their communities. And so it is time for us to test the translation device again. The time traveler treks into the ancient forest on the hunt for Homo heidelbergensis. Picking up the scent of smoke, he follows his nose. Eventually, he reaches a clearing, and there, at last, he finds his ancestors, lounging in the warmth of a fire, snacking on seeds and fruit. Just as before, he holds up his gift of eggs, pointing to the fire. One of the males, a large, stocky figure, looks up. He makes a soft cooing sound, a long vowel, ah, then an ee-oo. It's not quite speech, not as we know it, but there's a structure to these noises. They're not entirely random. The inventor holds up the translator and lets it absorb the words. The male continues to speak, his hands making simple gestures to clarify meaning. It feels like watching a toddler learning to talk, their communication full of intention, but lacking refined articulation. Another member of the group joins in, echoing the same cooing sound, but this time adding a humming-like sound, drawing out the syllables. Could this be emphasis or agreement? The translation device pipes up. Egg, dirt, fire. They dig a small hole with a stick, take the egg, place it in the hole, and cover it up. A makeshift oven. The tribe members nod in encouragement. The traveler has made contact. Homo heidelbergensis may not have a full language, but they likely had meaningful vocal communication. They could get meaning across through their primitive speech. It feels like we have reached the earliest point of human-like vocalizations. The hyoid bone allows them to be more nuanced with sound and pitch. Before them, their ancestors had air sacs, and perhaps other anatomical differences. And so, can earlier ancestors tell us if this ability for complex communication happened gradually, or all at once? The traveller decides to travel back once again. A small baby lies on a playmat, her eyes wide, absorbing the world around her. She's 6 or 7 months old, still a long way from speaking her first words. But if you watch closely, you'll notice how her tiny hands move in rhythmic, repetitive motions. She is exhibiting manual babbling. Manual babbling, like vocal babbling, is an early form of communication. It can be observed in children who are consistently exposed to sign language, whether they are deaf, born to deaf families, or learning systems like Makaton. And this ability to engage in manual language before verbal language suggests a deep-seated ability to create meaning with gesture. The fact that even before infants can form words, they are capable of expressing themselves through their hands demonstrates that tiny humans are wired for communication through movement first. Indeed, babies cry from day one and smile and laugh from mere months old, forms of communication, however rudimentary. The presence of manual babbling and the ability of people with hearing or speech impediments to use sign language shows us clearly that communication is not inherently tied to speech. It relies only on symbols and structured rules. It is our brain's ability to process patterns, whether through sound or movement, that underpins our capacity for language. And so if gesture is a fundamental part of communication, how far back does this ability go? If the time traveler continues his journey back through time, he might be able to pinpoint when symbolic communication first arose. And so he settles on his next trip. It will be a visit to Australopithecus afarensis, one of our earliest ancestors. Australopithecus afarensis lived 3.9 to 2.9 million years ago. They inhabited diverse landscapes across East Africa, and were already bipedal, walking upright on two legs, but still perhaps spent some time in the trees, as they retained some features suited for tree climbing, such as curved fingers and strong upper limbs. Standing around 3.5 to 5 feet tall, they had small brains, roughly one-third the size of a modern human's. Their environment was a mosaic of woodlands, savannas, and river valleys, offering both dense vegetation for foraging and open grasslands for scavenging and hunting small prey. They shared their world with large predators, such as ancient big cats and crocodiles, making group cooperation and vigilance essential for survival. And so despite their primitive nature, Australopithecus afarensis was a vital link in human evolution, bridging the gap between tree-dwelling apes and the later hominins that would develop more complex behaviors and technologies. And while we can't directly reconstruct their communication, fossil evidence does provide important clues. Like modern primates, Australopithecus afarensis had a hyoid bone, a key structure in vocalization. However, their hyoid was more similar to that of chimpanzees than to modern humans. And so clearly it was somewhere between Homo heidelbergensis and these Australopithecus afarensis that air sacs were discarded. For Australopithecus afarensis, this suggests that their vocal tract was likely not well suited for complex speech, and they vocalized more like chimpanzees. Loud screeches, hoots and calls, but with limited ability to produce varied, nuanced sounds. But did these calls convey meaning beyond what we see in modern chimps? We can't be sure, but there's a strong argument that Australopithecus afarensis would have supplemented their vocalizations with gestures, because we see this method of communication in all great apes today. Unlike vocalizations, which in many animals are instinctual, ape gestures are learned and intentional. These are not random movements. They follow patterns and can be used across different social situations. For example, an arm raise means let's play, and a beckoning gesture means come closer. Indeed, chimpanzees and bonobos even share some common gestures. A research team studied a group of chimpanzees in Uganda and found that these gestures are understood at a faster rate than human speech. On average, chimp gestures received a response within 120 milliseconds. The speed of human conversation is slower. Conversational turn-taking averages 200 milliseconds between responses. Gesture, then, is clearly a very efficient and useful communication tool. But the question is it efficient enough so that it could have been the first step towards true language? This is an idea that has its roots in the late 19th century with the German psychologist Wilhelm Wundt. Wundt set up the first psychology lab at the University of Leipzig, finally making psychology its own separate scientific field. Believing that mental processes could be broken down into basic parts, like chemistry breaks down substances or a recipe into steps, Wundt suggested that human language started with gestures before spoken words developed. Indeed, he saw gestures as direct manifestations of thought, writing that, for example, pointing was not only the simplest, but also the most primary gesture in the effort to communicate. Although Wundt's ideas were not based on experimental data, simply observations of use of gesture in primates and its seemingly universal use across human cultures, his ideas were prescient and foreshadowed later research in cognitive science and anthropology. Indeed, there are a huge number of examples of apes in captivity using gesture to communicate their needs, particularly apes who have been raised among humans. Like Washo, a female chimpanzee raised by researchers Alan and Beatrix Gardner. They taught her over 250 signs, but what surprised researchers was the way that she, and other chimps that she lived with, used them creatively, even displaying what some interpret as swearing. Taught the sign for dirty to describe soiled objects during toilet training, Washo repurposed it as an insult. When frustrated with a caretaker, she signed Dirty Roger, and she was seen signing Dirty Monkey towards a macaque that annoyed her. This behavior mirrored human swearing, adapting a word with negative connotations into an emotional expression, and so perhaps swearing through gesture may have preceded any of our modern, elaborate swear words. But while a lot of evidence comes from the study of great apes, the connection between gestures and speech is also reflected in the brain. Broca's area, a key region for speech production, is not just activated by speech, but also during hand movements. Although, while the gesture-first hypothesis remains influential, many modern linguists and anthropologists believe the origin of language lay in a mixture of gesture, vocalization, and facial expressions, pre-language communication involving them all. Instead of a strict transition from gesture to speech, modern research suggests a gradual interplay between multiple forms of expression, with spoken language ultimately becoming dominant. And so what would Australopithecus afarensis have been capable of? To begin with, we know from fossil evidence and the famous Lucy footprints that Australopithecus afarensis was bipedal, meaning their hands were free for more consistent, complex gesturing. We also know that they had larger brains than modern apes, and endocasts show evidence that they had a modern, human-like Broca's area. Indeed, one of the best-known fossils, the tongue child, provides insight into early brain reorganization related to communication. The tongue child is a 2.8 million-year-old Australopithecus africanus fossil discovered in 1924, and its well-preserved skull has been heavily studied. Modern digital reconstruction shows an enlarged Broca's area compared to other primates, suggesting a higher level of communication ability. As before, the inventor is preparing to ask his question. Can his translation device be used to ask Australopithecus afarensis how to cook an egg? He wades through a patch of grass in a wide plain of East Africa, surrounded by dry heat and scattered trees. Nearby, a small group of Australopithecus afarensis watches warily. Finally, the inventor speaks, but the translator beeps ineffectually. He pauses, thinks, and then tries something else. He mimes cracking the egg against a rock, then pretends to eat. The male Australopithecus steps forward, letting out a series of short, rhythmic grunts interspersed with hand motions. His hands mimic the shape of an egg, then a movement that might mean breaking or opening. He points at the inventor, then at himself. The inventor sets his translator to video capture. There is a loud beep, and the translation device gives its results. Break egg. Eat egg. The male grabs the egg from the inventor's hands, then smashes it open against a rock. He lifts it to his mouth and gulps it down whole. No fire here, no boiling or frying. They have communicated. Is this the first language? And so while Australopithecus afarensis was not capable of true language or any developed vocal communication much more advanced than our primate cousins, the basic structures of communication, pattern signals, shared meanings, and learned gestures were likely already in place. Indeed, there is a strong argument that the ability to produce intentional gestures and vocalizations that lay the groundwork for human speech were here, the roots of humanity's communication journey. And so as the inventor sits back and watches his new Australopithecus friend licking the last remnants of raw egg from his fingers, the cogs of his mind turn. If it works on gestures and grunts, just how far back can he test this device? In the dense, moonlit forests of Southeast Asia, the tarsier, a small, wide-eyed primate, sits in a hole in a tree. You might pass by a tarsier and imagine it to be a silent creature, but this is not the case. Tarsiers engage in a form of communication we are not privy to. They emit ultrasonic calls, frequencies so high that they evade the hearing range of not just humans, but more importantly, the hearing of their predators and competitors. Unlike the shrieks of other nocturnal creatures, a tarsier's vocalizations cut through the thick jungle air unheard by any other creature, except their own kind. These high-pitched calls serve as both social signals and territorial warnings, allowing tarsiers to coordinate movements, locate mates, and defend their dominion without attracting unwanted attention. Evolution has fine-tuned this adaptation, granting them a near-exclusive auditory channel amid a cacophony of jungle noises. Combined with their acute night vision and spring-loaded limbs, their ultrasonic speech makes them both efficient hunters and elusive prey. In their own acoustic world, they whisper secrets no other species can hear. We know mammals communicate in a variety of ways. From the mournful songs of whales to the warning calls of meerkats, their vocalizations, body language, and even scent marking demonstrate rich forms of non-verbal signaling that establish social structure, convey danger, and possibly even communicate emotions. Birds, too, produce complex songs with regional dialects and learned vocal patterns, whereas reptiles and amphibians use body postures, color changes, and vibrations to signal territory or court mates. And so logically, if we can see signs of communication in such a variety of organisms, it must surely have a truly ancient start. So where does communication really begin? We have journeyed from Homo sapiens, who had a basic language with words and perhaps some syntax, through to the world of Australopithecus afarensis over 3 million years ago, where gesture likely played a far more dominant role in communication. But what do we consider communication? The answer partly depends on how we define it. If communication is simply the exchange of meaningful information between entities, then it arguably starts with life itself, embedded in the very chemistry that led to evolution. So how far back could the inventor's device pick up and interpret communication? Let's find out. Our first stop will be a short one, to visit Ardipithecus ramidus, who lived over 4 million years ago and whose fossilized remains have been found in Ethiopia. There are few fossils to study, but some scientists have suggested that this ancestor's bipedal, but not fully erect, posture, combined with changes in craniological morphology, such as reduced facial and jaw length, could have increased vocal ability. Some have even speculated that this hominin might have produced musical, song-like calls. But this is highly contested. But given that Ardipithecus lived a million years before the time of Salam and her hyoid bone, it's hard to imagine that it had any vocal abilities that exceed those of modern non-human apes. So it's likely the species the inventor finds is one of budding potential rather than definitive progress. Ardipithecus's erect posture may have left it with a larger degree of cervical lordosis or neck curvature than our chimpanzee cousins. This could perhaps have led to increased mobility of the larynx and thus increased capacity to modulate vocalizations, or maybe this change in our ancestor's morphology was simply a potential for vocal development, to be developed by later hominins. Given the current fossil record, it's perhaps most likely that the inventor finds a creature, standing more or less upright and looking back at him, appearing to be in a perfect position to respond and communicate further, but whose voice and meanings are not yet too dissimilar from other apes. Perhaps the device would register gestures towards the egg, similar to those of a chimpanzee, being directed by a brain of around chimpanzee size. And so between Australopithecus and now Ardipithecus, the inventor appears to have pushed further back than any truly human-like communication. But many millions of years of evolutionary history still await his exploration. If gestures did indeed exist before vocalizations, what came before them? 55 million years ago. Here, he encounters early primate-like mammals, Adapiforms. These small, tree-dwelling creatures live in a world dominated by warm, dense forests stretching across what is now North America, Europe, and Asia. They are some of the earliest members of the primate lineage. Fossil evidence reveals that these creatures had well-developed bony ear structures, a telltale sign of higher levels of auditory sensitivity. This likely means that sound played a crucial role in their survival. Whether in detecting predators rustling in the underbrush, or in communicating with one another through high-pitched calls. When the inventor takes out his device, he thinks it's broken at first, as no sound comes from its speaker. But then he sees a return call, registering on the device as lines and squiggles. There is a reply from somewhere in the jungle, one he cannot hear without help. A seemingly silent creature given, for a moment, a chance to be heard by human ears. The inventor seeks these early primates for hours, but can never get close enough. He must find something less elusive, larger perhaps. So, for the next part of his adventure, he's going Jurassic. Can he communicate with dinosaurs? This far back in time, dinosaurs roamed the planet for many millions of years. Between 245 million to 66 million years ago, it becomes much harder to piece together answers. We have a good number of dinosaur fossils, but soft tissue does not last buried deep in the earth. However, we can study their bones and try our best to guess at how they made their way through the world. Dinosaurs, of course, are a broad church, and through their many millennia of dominance, they changed and evolved. Fossil evidence does suggest some hadrosaurs had elaborate resonating chambers in their skulls, which may have allowed them to produce deep, resonant calls for long-distance communication. Similarly, large dinosaurs, like sauropods, could have used low-frequency rumbles, much like modern elephants, to signal over vast distances. And theropods, the ancestors of birds, probably didn't sound much like birds at all, They might have vocalized using growls, similar to crocodilian bellows. However, much of this remains speculative, based on comparisons with their closest living relatives, birds and reptiles. Beyond sound, however, we are reasonably sure that visual communication was likely crucial to many dinosaurs. We know some species had elaborate crests, frills or feathers, like Triceratops, and we can guess that these would have been used much like some birds use their own adornments today, as displays of courtship, dominance, or warning signals. We also think that some dinosaurs had colourful plumage. We've seen evidence in smaller theropods, having found fossilised melanosomes, tiny pigment-containing organelles found inside cells responsible for coloration in animals. If they had colour, perhaps that colour had purpose. And so when the inventor arrives at our 67 million year old planet, he is quick to set up his translation device. He takes stock, looking about a dense and tropical jungle, the humidity and heat almost unbearable. But thankfully, it does not take long to prepare. He twists some knobs, presses some buttons, and from the device comes a deep, resonant, low-frequency sound, like a bellow or the low pitch of a bassoon. For a moment, there is silence, and then all at once, a similar sound, but much louder, making the trees shiver. The inventor checks the device and peers into the foliage. Studies of T-Rex skull structure suggest it lacked a complex vocal apparatus like a songbird, meaning it's more likely to have made closed-mouth vocalizations, similar to doves or ostriches, though much, much louder. Catching his breath, the inventor, safe in his time machine, decides that is enough of the age of reptiles. And so he decides on somewhere a little less frightening, though only just. It is Earth 300 million years ago. Pre-dinosaurs, this is a time dominated by early insects. Giant, millipede-like creatures and scorpions scuttle about unimpeded by mammals or even reptiles. Like their descendants, these arthropods probably communicated using a mixture of chemical, visual, tactile, and vibrational signaling. They might have relied on pheromones to mark territory, attract mates, or warn of danger, much like ants laying scent trails. Indeed, many modern arthropods use substrate vibrations to communicate, including crickets, who produce sound by rubbing their wings, and spiders, who sense vibrations in their webs. The inventor stumbles through this new jungle towards a sound like a million fingernail scratches on cardboard. A cacophony of noises fills the thick, hot air. A group of ancient, cricket-like insects is assembled on tree trunks, on the ground, on leaves. He starts up his translation machine, but instead of a sound, it provides instructions. The inventor frowns, but he does follow along. He takes the machine and starts rubbing it intensely against a tree. It elicits a scratchy vibrato, and all at once, the cricket-like creatures rise into the air as one giant swarm, beating their translucent wings in unison, and fly off into the sky. Where else is there to go? The inventor wonders. Surely this must be the limit of all communication. Unless there is one final stop on the journey. To the very beginning, more than 3.5 billion years ago, the dawn of life. The very first unicellular organisms roil and roll in the primordial soup. The inventor cannot believe he will find any kind of communication here. And yet, even in these very first known life forms, bacteria, there is still an exchange of information. Bacteria today use quorum sensing, a release and detection of signaling molecules, which allow them to coordinate behaviors like colony formation, biofilm production, or even collective attacks on host organisms. And quorum sensing is thought to be incredibly ancient. If we consider this to be the most rudimentary form of interaction as communication, then we could argue the communication predates even multicellular life. And so finally, the inventor wades into a deep pool of water, populated by simple organic compounds and bacteria. It is unclear if the device is influencing the single cellular organisms, but the inventor believes he is finally here, at the start, the beginning of communication. This ability to share, to coordinate, to cooperate, is integral to all existence. From the bubbling chaos of the primordial soup to the subtle dance of human conversation, communication has always been a survival tool. First for cells, then for species, and finally for civilizations. What began as chemical whispers between single-celled organisms evolved into the hand signals of early hominins, and eventually the intricate languages, both vocal and silent, that shape our world today. And yet despite these cultural leaps, the essence of communication remains the same. The need to connect, to share, to understand. From the first flicker of life to this very moment, every great leap forward has started with a simple exchange. One message sent, and crucially, one received. You've been watching the entire history of humankind. Don't forget to follow the link or the QR code to get a 14-day free trial from our sponsor today, MyHeritage. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.